This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network's Animal Studies channel. My name is Kyle Johansson, and I recently became a host on this channel. Today, I'm very happy to be interviewing Dr. Maxwell Foran about his book, The Subjugation of Canadian Wildlife, Failures of Principle and Policy. His book was published by McGill-Queen's University Press in 2018 as part of the press's Rural Wildland and Resource Studies series. Dr. Foran is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Communication, Media, and Film at the University of Calgary. Welcome to the podcast, Max.
Thanks, Carl. Well, good to be here.
Yeah, great. So could you please tell us a bit about yourself, such as where you're from, what topics you work on, or anything else you think the listeners might want to know about you?
Well, there's not a great deal to tell, Carl. I was born and raised in Australia. I came to Canada in 1963 to marry a tall Canadian, beautiful Canadian lady who was very interested in wildlife, and we were married in 63, and we lived in an acreage at Prittis near Calgary. I spent most of my career in public education, both as a teacher and an administrator, and the last 15 or 16 years teaching at the University of Calgary.
Okay. Well, listen, before I ask you any other questions, one thing I'd like to do is just thank you for writing an animal studies book about wild animals, because there's a growing animal studies literature, and a lot of it is about domesticated animals. Most of it is about domesticated animals, but wild animals have been kind of a neglected topic within animal studies, and so I think books like yours are really important. So yeah, so thanks for working on a neglected topic. Yeah. So why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I was sitting on the Chesterfield about 2009, and Heather was sitting opposite me, and she said suddenly, "Max, I want you to write a book on wildlife." And I remember saying, "What? It's not my field." And then she said to me, "I can't write it. No one else can, except you. And I want you to write it, and you know what we believe, and I want you to do it for me." And I said, "Done, mate, done." And so I began it in 2013, the year she was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. I finished the first draft in 2016. And the second draft, the end of 2016, by which time Heather was very, very sick. And I got news it was going ahead from McGill Queens in the spring of 2017. I told Heather, "I think she got it. I think she got it." And she smiled. And it was published a year later, and she died in May 2017. And it was published in June 2018, and I wrote it for her.
So this is a very personal work, I guess, for you.
Yes, it was. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, so I guess let's get into the content of the book. So much of your book is, in one way or another, about the belief system that underpins wildlife management practices in Canada. Your book argues that management practices under this belief system subjugate or dominate wild animals, and that this subjugation in turn threatens environmental values like habitat and biodiversity. So I'm wondering, before we talk about anything else, can you please describe the belief system that underpins wildlife management in Canada?
I think to introduce this, I never argued in the book that wildlife professionals and management professionals were not doing their job properly, professionally, adequately, and conscientiously. What I did contest was a belief system that underpinned their actions was flawed in that it assumes the instrumentality of all animals. It assumes the thingness of animals. It assumes they lack conscious states. And if you go along with those beliefs, the next obvious conclusion is that these animals have no moral standing, no sense of who they are, and no sense of ethical worth, and therefore can be exploited by humans morally and ethically, except all this instrumental position argues that all animals can expect from us is a reasonable level of kind treatment and, when necessary, a quick and painless death. Even animal charities cannot get a charitable number unless they can demonstrate that the charity will benefit humanity. In other words, a wild animal's existence has all to do with humanity and not with itself. And I say that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Now, thanks for making that distinction. It seems important that you want to blame the belief system, but not blame the wildlife managers.
Could you speak up a bit,
Carl? Oh, sure. It just struck me that, you're noting that, you're being critical in the book, but what you're really critical of is the belief system and not so much the managers who are working within the belief system. Yeah. Okay. Now, I'm wondering, do you think that the same, because your book is about wildlife management in Canada specifically, but the beliefs of Canadians are not completely idiosyncratic. I'm wondering if you think that the same belief system underpins wildlife management in a lot of other countries too.
Without doubt. I suppose it might be, you might have more sensitive wildlife policies in countries where wildlife are not an issue anymore, when they've extirpated them all. And certainly in some African countries where wildlife is linked directly to tourism, there's some sort of conscious need to do something. But generally, particularly in first world countries, and particularly in Canada, where wildlife abundance is quite rich, this belief prevails. But I think the belief about animals is held by, that's pretty straight standard Christian tradition. You know that. Christianity has a jaundiced view of God's concern for its wild creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a topic that I'm interested in myself. The relationship between Christianity specifically and beliefs we have about wild animals. A lot of people aren't that religious anymore. But it seems like that we've inherited a yeah.
But you can contend, even without being religious, the argument is that because what animals, wildlife, cannot communicate with you and me in languages that we can understand, we therefore can adopt the parsimony principle quite freely and not do anything. In other words, because we don't know means it doesn't matter. And as Nagel said in his article, What It's Like to Be a Bat, that's patently. What do they call it? The lowest level of cognitive dissonance or something like that. And that's a mistake we make, you know. That's classic behaviorism, logical positivism. You know that better than I do.
All right. Well, so quite a lot of the book tries to show that valuing wildlife in an anthropocentric manner also threatens wildlife, that it ends up undermining conservation efforts.
Yeah.
I'm hoping you can say a bit about why valuing wildlife anthropocentrically leads to the rationalization of harmful policies. And if you could give some examples too, that'd be great.
The fundamental rationalization is that no wildlife policy can exist without a human component. That's the first thing. Every wildlife policy has to consider the human dimension. And that in enough is enough to make it anthropogenic. But I can give you, you know, several examples. The Species at Risk Act will not list the polar bear as threatened or endangered, because if it did, then all hunting would be prohibited. That's not on. Similarly for the wolverine. The wolverine also is not listed when, according to its number specifics, maybe it should be. And then there are the recent changes in the Fisheries Act, which defined critical habitat, changed the definition of critical habitat from having a habitat suitable for all fish to fish that only have commercial value. And then you have particularly edible fish like the bluefin tuna and the poor beagle shark, which are endangered, but which are not listed under the Species at Risk Act because the fisheries people, Federal Fisheries Agency, says we can handle this, we'll run this in order to preserve our fisheries. In other words, a Species at Risk Act, which exists over and above all cabinet ministries, apparently doesn't. And so what you see is a lot of examples where human interest comes first. Protected areas, same way. It's all the same. The human dimension is there. It is impossible under the belief system to consider wildlife as autonomous communities. Impossible.
All right. Well, I've got a bunch of questions here that are basically related to the last one. So this belief system has like lots of different features, and maybe we can get into some of the specific features of the belief system. So part of the belief system, or actually maybe the biggest part, I don't know, is that it sees wild animals as resources. We can think of other resources too, you know, coal, oil, natural gas, et cetera. I was hoping you could explain what it means to treat wild animals as resources
You might have noticed how I was laughing when you mentioned a resource. That's so stupid. I mean, a resource means able to be used. You resort to something, therefore you use it. And so you're labeling wildlife as a resource. Now, first of all, if indeed it is a resource, then it must compete with other resources for budgeting and priority. And compared to mining, agriculture, lumber, wildlife are way, way down on the list of resource priorities and therefore gets minimal amount of funding. That's the first point. The second point is, to equate an aggregate of living beings with truck rolls of coal is pretty sad to me. Wildlife are not a resource. They're not ours to be used. But if we must kind of group them in a category, as a federal category or a provincial category, maybe a trust rather than resource, because the trust demands attention, a trust demands close observation, whereas a resource just means money, 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 money. And to call wildlife a research is the height, in my opinion, of human arrogance.
Okay, thanks. I take it that one of the issues here with labeling wildlife a resource is that compared to other resources, I mean, you kind of said this already, but compared to some of the other resources that the Canadian government is concerned with, wildlife is not and at least in a lot of cases, not a very lucrative resource relative to other ones. And so when you have conflicts between which resources you want to prioritize and particularly, yeah, so like...
Exactly, Kyle. Exactly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, if it's a choice between habitat and energy development or something like that, often, yeah. Okay. Well, look, so another part of the belief system is that it sees wild animals as a bunch of different species rather than as individuals. I was hoping you could explain this idea and explain why seeing wild animals as species instead of as individuals is a problem.
Well, the trouble with calling, I mean, we generalize as humans. We talk about Canadians and Americans or groups that we have, but we do identify people by groups. Yeah. But we acknowledge that within those groups, the individual is significant. All individuals cannot. When you label wildlife when you classify wildlife in species specific terms, what you are doing is removing them completely from any relationship with us, because they only exist as a collective. A deer are deer, an individual doe or fawn, it doesn't count. It's just an individual deer. And the third point is you manage according to this collective, and you use a language, a discourse that diminishes them further. Culling, harvesting, population management, game management, these are derogatory. And by continuing to label animals as species-specific terms, you are neutralizing them. No, not neutral. Sorry, bad word. You are neutering them vis-a-vis us, and they don't count. And the language of discourse just backs it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, thanks.
That answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I take it that if the belief system were to honor wild animals as individuals more, I mean, one of the implications that you think this would have is that it would lead us in the direction of compassionate conservation. So we'd be using conservation techniques that do function to pursue the same goals as conservation tends to some extent, but which are less harmful to animals. So, for example, instead of using hunting to control the size of a wild animal population, we might be inclined to use a contraceptive to control the size of that population, because something like a contraceptive is not going to be killing animals, right? It's a desirable alternative, but it's only going to be viewed as desirable once we acknowledge that individual animals matter, that their lives matter, right? Yeah. Okay. So a third part of the belief system is that it holds a fixed in time conception of ecological integrity. Can you describe the fixed in time conception and what it has to do with anthropocentrism?
Yeah, that's the Canadian historical environmentalist said, Stephen Bocking said, that if you ask any scientist or biologist for a definition of ecological integrity, you get a different answer every one of them. My answer is ecological integrity, the term, is no more than a social construct. There is no such thing as looking at ecological integrity. It's always in a state of flux. And so because we believe that we stand outside nature and we are not really part of ecological integrity, we see our role is in maintaining it and trying to keep our ecological balance in proper perspective. But that's ridiculous, because there is no static nature of ecological integrity. There cannot be. It's an ongoing, never-ending process. But we don't do that. We set a state that we think, and what's the biodiversity strategy say? It says something typical to what it would be in nature. Oh, come on. That's meaningless. And then tries to manage according to that definition. And what this means is by punishing offenders. Too many deer. wild horses in Alberta trampling down the environment and get rid of them. Don't worry about the cattle are doing the same thing. It's an opportunity to do what you want under what a pseudo scientific rationale, and it doesn't work. And I can see why you do it, because you've got no choice. What else are we going to do? But for crying out loud, if you're going to do it, try to integrate the components into your management styles as best you can, and taking out offenders is not the best way. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but yeah, part of what I'm interested in is
Well, what do you mean then?
I guess when I was reading the book and what you had to say about this, it seemed to me that there's a pretty close relationship between this fixed in time conception and our cultural values, the way we value history. It's like we're treating nature as like a museum or something like that. It's full of artifacts that remind us of our past, and we want those artifacts to stay there because we care about our past. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the way it should look. Nice and green and wetlands, and let's keep it that way, but keep it that way by including us in it, by keeping ourselves aside from us, by managing ourselves. And you can't manage a system, ecological integrity, when you're part of the whole darn system yourself. So how can you stand outside and manage it? So all you can do is do what you're doing, but don't go being conclusive and deterministic about it. You just try to include the best you can by leaving things alone as much as you can and interfering minimally. But we don't do this. We don't do this because there's so many pressures on us, the decision makers, that, I mean, the cormorants on Middle Island, I mean, they got a whole fixed-in-time conception about what everything looked like before the cormorants. Well, everything didn't look that great before the cormorants, but they were to blame for destroying it. And so you like too many deer. Saskatchewan killed 70,000 coyotes. Didn't need it, but for no reason. But to maintain the balance. Whose balance? Human balance. And I understand that. I'm simply saying that as long as you continue to think in those terms, wildlife will be continually prejudiced. Simple as that. I'm going to be a rocket scientist.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Now, I guess this is my last question. That's about the details of the belief system, or it's related to that. But so throughout the book, you're pretty critical of something called adaptive management, and I was hoping you could explain that's a technical term. I was hoping you could explain what adaptive management is, but also why it's related to the anthropocentric belief system.
Well, first of all, let me look at the definition, the precautionary principle adopted by Coswick. Now, Coswick is the group that advises the listing of animals to the federal government, the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada. Encoded in Coswick is the statement, is the precautionary principle. No proactive action should be taken with any wildlife until the results are scientifically certain as possible. Now, adaptive management says exactly the opposite. Adaptive management refers to thinking on the job, realizing that outcomes are impossible to determine accurately, so you change on the go, you experiment and see what things work, and try to refine your management techniques by trying out new things. Okay, that goes against the precautionary principle. But it also goes further than that, because what it really means is a carte blanche license to do what you want. When the walls were culled in BC, they're shooting them from helicopters because eating caribou. And one of the lead negotiators said in public, "We're trying to figure out if this thing works." And we're using adaptive management answers to cull moose in parks on the grounds that we want to see what happens. If we cull enough moose in this national park, maybe we haven't got to do some restorative actions. In other words, it's a license to do carte blanche, and it pursued rigorously, it would have a place. But it's come to mean pretty well anything you want, depending on what jurisdiction. But it simply means do what you want. And as a result, lethal actions are taken which violate the precautionary principle. And I go up no further than that. You've got an agency of government which is committed to a precautionary principle. I think it's outlined in the biodiversity strategy too. I wouldn't bet my farm on it. And you've got a policy which runs counter to those two things. And it just doesn't make sense. It's convenient. Makes things easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. So there's nothing, in your view, nothing wrong with adaptive management in and of itself, if it were sort of used responsibly.
Oh no, there's a good things. There's a good things. If you follow the six steps, and if you follow the routines you have to follow in order to get the results, yes. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about its rampant prostitution, which amounts to do what you want, and it's justification to do what you want. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. If it works, oh, that's good. So the casualties, the collateral damage is an accepted, and that goes against the precautionary principle, encoded in Coswick.
Okay, yeah.
I don't get it.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
All right. Well, let's move on. So in your chapter on threats to habitat, you have a section discussing agriculture and the various ways in which growing crops, especially genetically modified crops, threaten wild animals' habitat. And I enjoyed reading the chapter, but I thought this would be an opportunity to press you a little bit. So you one thing you don't discuss is the relationship between animal agriculture and the amount of crops that we need to grow. So as some of our listeners are probably aware, a lot of the crops that are grown in Canada and the United States and elsewhere are just grown as feed crops. They're used to just feed livestock. And the proportion of feed crops to non-feed crops is pretty high. We use most of the crops that we grow are actually just grown as feed crops for feeding livestock. And I was wondering if you could say a bit about this. In particular, I'm wondering if you think that reducing the consumption of animal products is really important for protecting habitat.
That's a fair question, Carl. I didn't focus on it as much. I agree with you. whole attitude towards food production must change in order to maximize the land that we have. I didn't deal with it because it brought the domesticated animals into play. And I didn't want to do that, Kyle. I mean, my first draft of the book was much larger, and I discussed things like industrial farming and discussed the sort of stuff you're talking about. But I realized I leaned it down. But yes, it is a big issue. It is a big issue. And as part of just a bigger idea that what I think what threatens wildlife most of all is not conscious persecution of wild animals because of whatever rationale. It's the inadvertent danger caused by destruction of habitat, and habitat is prejudicial to wildlife most of all, lack of habitat. And your point is part of the big picture of as habitat dwindles, so will wildlife.
Okay. I guess you agree then that this is an important part of protecting habitat. It's not all there is to protecting habitat, but one of the things we probably should be doing collectively.
Could you speak up, Carl? Oh. I can't hear you. I've got these earphones on.
Even though you don't say it in the book, you do think that we all ought to be trying to reduce the amount of animal products that we eat. This is the environmentally responsible thing to do. Okay. I was just trying to press you on. So I'm vegan myself, and one of the things I like to talk about is just the consumption of animal products. And I was wondering how far you would go in that direction. Whether you think we really need to really be cutting back on animal products. Is this something that's really really important?
Yeah. And it's not just the animal products. The dairy industry is a horrific industry in terms of what it puts through. Yes. And there are alternatives out there, Carl. There are alternatives out there, but cultural mindsets are hard to change. And I do believe that we have a very expensive use of land, and we haven't got that much of it as arable. I suppose even pastoral usage does mitigate to a degree against browsing wildlife as well. So, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I'm with you.
Thanks.
Good. I'm with you.
All right, so I'm curious, what changes do you think need to be made to the belief system, the anthropocentric belief system, for wild animals and their habitat to be adequately protected?
There's only one doable one, because I don't believe the belief system will change. We will privilege ourselves. That's in our nature as a species. In fact, I once heard a definition of reason that said acting in one's own interest. Have you ever read that one, Kyle? A definition of reason, acting in one's own interest.
I'm not familiar with it.
Well, and I don't think we are going to act against our interest to that degree to make a big belief change. But what we can do, and that's what you ask, I think we should be more willing to dedicate larger tracts of land for wildlife exclusively. No hunting, no trapping, no mining, no human interference, nothing. I think the rewilding movement has some possibilities here, and I think it is possible to convince the body public that in our own interests, as your own interests, with all the problems facing us, it would behoove us to set aside more land, more marine land, for undisputed use of wildlife. I think that's doable. And I also think we could stop using the word rights. I think it's a political, it's a legal word, and now it's a politically laden word. And start to think of, I mean, we don't get upset with people we don't know. We just accept them. I don't know the guy down the road, but I respect his right. Wrong word. I respect his claim to act out his own life in his own way. And I think it's not about wildlife. I wasn't sentimental towards wildlife like Heather was. I wasn't at all. I feel an empathy towards them. I feel an empathy towards the thoughts of stuff they've got to deal with every day, like all of us. And I use my reason, my so-called human defining category or aspect to reach that conclusion. And I call that rational empathy. And I see no reason why we cannot, most of us, not all of us, it's impossible, but most of us can't have a more rationally and empathetic attitude towards wildlife. I don't know you that well. In fact, I don't know you at all. But I accept your right. As an autonomous being that they don't need us, I respect your right to live your life as I do mine. And I think if we can cultivate that in the young, that's not all about us as humans, because that's self-destructive. It's all about us as inhabitants of a planet, an imperiled planet. And wildlife don't ask much from us, Kyle. They don't ask very little from us. There are some incursions, yeah, and there will be, into our domains. But I see no reason why we can't develop a rational, empathetic position towards those that we don't know so well, but recognize that their right to exist on this planet is as good as ours.
Hmm. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so you have a, I mean, there was a couple of things you said there, or a few things. But I mean, so one of the things was related to one of your chapters on protected areas in Canada. And so we do have, you know, as you discuss in your book, we do have various areas such as provincial parks in Canada that are protected against certain uses by businesses and commercial interests. But one of the things you talk about in the book is how they're less protected than you'd think. And you think they should be sort of more protected, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, I think it's the whole attitude that no matter what we and everything has to contain a certain aspect of our control. Let it go. But I think we can do that. I mean, after all, wild creatures don't pay their taxes. And therefore, how could you be part of any political process, decision-making process, when the agents of that process don't pay their way? And there are some people who think like that. But I don't think that's... that attitude can be changed. And I think rather than letting... My point is not that there's already places where people's access is limited, but the notion... the existing and pervading notion that that existence must be provided, no matter how minimal, that's what I don't like. I mean, either open it up and say, yep, this is yours, and we don't touch it. But, gee, that's hard to do. If oil's discovered there, or some mineral, some rich other perspective, bottom line money gainer, no way. And so in a way, my argument is deterministic.
Well, all right. So another thing that came out in, I guess, in what you just said, and it's related to one of my questions. So you draw a contrast in the book between the animal rights view and other views that views that prioritize respect for wild animals' freedom or wild animals' autonomy. What you just said suggests you think that respect for wild animals' freedom is really important, and that goes hand in hand with your view that we should just set aside certain areas where we really don't interfere with wild animals' lives at all. We just leave them completely alone to do what they want. But you think that this is very different from an animal rights position. Could you say a bit more about this contrast, the difference between these views?
Thought I just did, but now what I will say, that the animal rights movement, it is directed primarily in a domestic animal regime, and the domestic animals are property. That's the issue. Domestic animals are property, and the animal rights people, I think, barked up the wrong tree originally. I would not have predicated my movement on domestic animals, because it's too much of a, it's too difficult, it's too entwined in human usage, and it's too entwined with a nation of property. Wildlife are no one's property, and they are autonomous sovereign communities. And if you concentrate on the rights of sovereign autonomous communities, already sovereign autonomous, then you've got a better chance of moving the discussion towards a wider scope. And I stayed away from that, Kyle, on purpose. I was staying away from domestic animals as much as possible. And I couldn't deal with, as you said, at the animal rights position without bringing domestic animals into it, and I wasn't going to do that. So hence, and I still like my rational empathy better than animal rights. But yeah, was my wife animal rights? Sure she was. But I like the term less and less these days because of how we're throwing that word rights around and how it's become a politically laden statement, not just legal connotation, but politically laden. So that's why I stayed away from animal rights.
Okay, yeah, I see. I remember there were certain points in the book when you pointed out how sometimes, I can't remember the specific examples, but I think governments in particular would, in order to be dismissive of a group that was concerned with protecting animals, they would label it an animal rights group, even though it really wasn't.
It's a pejorative. Yeah, you're true. That's another. Yeah, that's right. It's a pejorative. And it continues to be a pejorative and used very politically so. Animal rights wackos. You could throw that one into my argument as well. And politicians represent a very narrow spectrum of humanity. They've got vested interests. The body public is far more accepting of wildlife than the politicians, who have very narrow agendas, and they're not going to waste their little time on the floor or little time interrupting caucus in order to talk about animals and their rights. And so under our parliamentary system, kind of dead in the water.
All right. Well, we've managed to go through the questions I had in mind really reasonably quickly. I'm surprised we actually got through everything I kind of wanted to talk about.
Yeah, fire away. Any more?
I guess we'll just finish up here. Thanks again for joining us. We've been talking about your 2018 book, The Subjugation of Canadian Wildlife: Failures of Principle and Policy, which was published by McGill Queen's University Press. I think the only other question I have for you is whether you're currently working on any projects, and if so, what are you working on?
Sadly, as an older man, I'm reverted to fiction.
Fiction. That's
I write
wonderful.
Novels now. Yep. But I did write a novel, not published, that sits behind a could sit beside Subjugation as a nice compliment, a fictional version of the arguments I'm trying to make in Subjugation. I wrote it purposely to be a companion to Subjugation. I like that. But now I've gone on to other fictional projects. And, of course, I enjoy my place at Pritis. Heather and I, it's a conservation easement now, which I have a section, and you can't touch anything on it. So I like to preside over my place at Pritis and see the animals and muck around with fiction. It's at least in academic writing, I knew a little bit what I was doing, but fiction you don't, so that's why it's fun.
Yeah. Well, so you said that you've got a book that's meant as a companion to the book we're talking about. Is it just on your computer or has it been published?
No, it's got all my family got their own copy and read it, and it's on my computer.
Okay. Okay. Right. It'd be wonderful.
Are you interested in it?
I am a little interested. What's the name of the book?
Sites of Perdition. Sites of Perdition. You want a copy, just email me and I'll send you one, mate. A philosopher like you would like this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, good luck with all of your fiction projects. That sounds like a refreshing change, I think.
Yeah, thanks, Carl.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everyone.
So you want me to start?
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yeah.